This is Bradcast producer Desi Doyen. We're off today, so please enjoy this encore Bradcast from November 14th, 2024.
A fundamental principle of American democracy is that when we lose an election, we accept the results.
Fair enough. But let's just make sure you actually lost the election.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
Okay.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
Not too much to ask.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair.
Maybe it is.
And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs.
We'll see.
Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yes, I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA. Also in California, in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI and Round Mountains, KKRN. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KZO and Eugene's KEPW. Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU. In Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP. Rochester, New York's WRFZ. Down in New Orleans on WHIV. Out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ. Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN. Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ. In Seattle on KODX. Richmond, Virginia's WRWK. Fairmont, West Virginia's WEFR. Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR. And Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internets and the Progressive Voices Channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Detour Talk, and most of your favorite podcast sites. Blanketing Planet Earth, I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us, and welcome to the Bradcast. Longtime listeners and readers of the Brad blog know after elections, we spend a lot of time digging into reported voting and tabulation problems and various concerns about the results of those elections.
Because we think results of elections should be accurate.
Yes, we do. And we believe that the people ought to be able to know that they are accurate. And all of that is true, whether someone I may have supported in an election either won it or lost it. That was true when Hillary Clinton lost in 2016, when Bernie Sanders lost to Hillary Clinton that same year in the primary elections, when Donald Trump lost in 2020. And by the way, it was true way back in the early 2000s when, yes, I was occasionally an invited guest on Alex Jones's show,
yeah.
Believe it or not. That was before he was a completely insane right-wing conspiracy monger, back when he, too, had legitimate concerns about elections and our voting systems. And as you may have heard, there is some news about him today, which I hope to get to in a bit, along with a thought or two about my own experiences with Alex Jones, if time allows.
Trying to help him understand how elections work and what's accurate and what isn't.
In any event, oh, hi, Desi Doyen. I didn't even say your name. Hi. In any event, when it comes to investigating elections, I have, of course, been doing the same since Tuesday, November 5 of this year in the race between Donald Trump and Kamala Harris, which she conceded to Donald Trump on the morning after the election. Though it should be noted, concessions are a mere political nicety. They do not have any actual legal implications. With that said, late on Wednesday, our friends at the nonpartisan government watchdog FreeSpeechForPeople.org alerted us to this news, as FSFP explains in their news release. A group of computer security experts have written to Vice President Kamala Harris to alert her to the fact that voting systems were breached by Trump allies back in 2021 and 2022, and to urge her to seek recounts in key states to ensure election verification. Following the 2020 election, they note, operatives working with Trump attorneys accessed voting equipment in order to gain copies of the software that records and count votes. In fact, we broke news of perhaps the most significant, or at least one of the most well-known of those unlawful breaches of voting equipment on this show, along with the copying and the distribution of its proprietary voting system software in Coffee County, Georgia, back in 2022, when a frequent guest on this program and opponent of Georgia's unverifiable touchscreen voting systems, Marilyn Marks, revealed a phone call that she'd received and helpfully recorded from one of the members of the Trump team that had breached those voting systems beginning on January 7, 2021, the day after Donald Trump's attempted coup at the U.S. Capitol in hopes of stealing the 2020 election to stay in power.
You know, I'm the guy that chartered the jet to go down to Coffee County to have them inspect all of those computers. And they scanned all the equipment, imaged all the hard drives.
They imaged the hard drives?
Yes.
How in the world did you get permission to do that?
We basically had the entire elections committee there. Okay. And they said, we give you permission. Go for it.
Go for it. Now, we have been reporting on that software breach and others and warning about their long tail dangers pretty consistently on the Bradcast and Bradblog.com ever since, including the news that Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger, despite the unprecedented breach, had refused to patch the statewide touchscreen voting systems with security updates that were created for it by the vendor and strongly recommended for it by the U.S. Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. Raffensperger said he refused to do that until after the 2024 election. Now, the letter to Vice President Harris from these longtime, highly respected voting system and cybersecurity experts argues that this extraordinary and unprecedented breach in election system security merits conducting recounts of paper ballots in order to confirm as best as possible the computer-generated results. Now, remember, pretty much all of the results we currently know about regarding the November 5 election at this time are based solely on computer-tallied scans of those ballots. Those scans are either correct or they're incorrect, and without verification by human beings actually examining those paper ballots and comparing the totals to those that are reported by the computers, well, there's simply no way to know either way if they are correct or incorrect. As the experts write, quote, in the light of the breaches, we ask that you formally request hand counts in at least the states of Michigan, Nevada, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania. We have no evidence that the outcomes of the elections in those states were actually compromised as a result of the security breaches, and we are not suggesting that they were, but binding risk-limiting audits, or RLAs, or hand recounts should be routine for all elections, especially when the stakes are high and the results are close, as was certainly the case in those states and in others this year. The letter also highlights the fact that the post-election audits of a sampling of ballots in many key states, such that states carry out such a process at all. Many do not. But that those audits will largely be only conducted after certification and after the window to seek official recounts actually closes. And that therefore recounts must be sought promptly. The letter states, quote, possessing copies of the voting system software enables bad actors to install it on electronic devices and to create their own working replicas of the voting systems, probe them, and develop exploits. Skilled adversaries can decompile the software to get a version of the source code, study it for vulnerabilities, and could even develop malware designed to be installed with minimal physical access to the voting equipment by unskilled accomplices to manipulate the vote counts. Attacks, they note, could also be launched by compromising the vendors responsible for programming systems before elections, enabling large-scale distribution of malware. Now, in fact, I've reported on this show since November 5 and have been speaking with experts and scientists and people on the ground about a number of reports of scanned ballots that failed to upload correctly to the central tabulator in battleground jurisdictions like Center County, Pennsylvania, where a batch of some 13,000 absentee ballots were supposedly correctly scanned, but they did not register at all within the Election Management System, or EMS, when they were supposed to be added to the rest of the county's tallies. And in Calhoun County, Michigan, the town of Battle Creek, where a similarly still unexplained problem reportedly occurred with a batch of around 3,000 absentee ballots. In both cases, the problems were eventually noticed and the ballots were retallied, hopefully accurately, but apparent programming errors like that could be a sign of a simple mistake or of a malware attack gone bad. Again, there is no way to know until ballots are actually counted by hand, by humans, and potentially the software on those systems is examined by professionals. As the experts write in their letter this week to Vice President Harris regarding the earlier known breaches of voting system software by Donald Trump supporters in states like Georgia and Michigan and Pennsylvania, quote, "In December 2022 and again in 2023, many of us concerned by the security risks posed by these breaches wrote to the Attorney General, the FBI Director, and Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency Director outlining the security concerns and urging an investigation. Though there have been limited localized investigations, there is no evidence of a federal investigation to determine what was done with the misappropriated voting software." Now, I will, of course, link to the full 5-page letter when posting today's show at bradblog.com this evening. It is signed by 7 such cybersecurity and voting system experts, a number of whom have been guests on this program several times over the years, including Professor and PhD Duncan Buell, the NCR Chair in Computer Science and Engineering at the University of South Carolina, and a longtime expert in voting systems. And yes, he joins us once again today. Professor Buell, it is always an honor to speak with you. Welcome back to the broadcast, my friend.
I am happy to be back. This is good.
Thank you.
It's not good why I am back,
right?
But it's good to be back.
It's good to have you back, even in these circumstances. All right, let me start here, Duncan, since the real concerns about voting system hardware and software have been made annoyingly murky in recent years following Trump's 2020 loss and a subsequent mountain of false or at least evidence-free claims and sometimes just outright lies about these systems since then. Did I mischaracterize the general concerns that you and the other longtime computer scientists and voting system security experts currently have about this year's reported election results to date?
My concern up until even this year was that from everything I had seen, the software involved, at least from ESNS, did not measure up to anything like standard quality control. I would tell my students in a third semester course that if they made the same mistakes, they would get no better than a C grade in a third semester undergraduate course for making those mistakes. I never saw malware. I never saw malfeasance. I saw any number of things that we try to teach students never to do. And they are pervasive in what I have observed from the ESNS software.
So above and beyond the theft of the software and what could be done with it. It sounds like you have concerns just with the software when it's working as designed.
Well, so my mantra has been that if the software cannot be used as intended mm-hmm. by the intended users, it is the software that is at fault and not the users. And the common complaint that, oh, it's human error mm-hmm. is, yes, it's human error, but some of that error was in the design and the implementation of the software itself. If it has not been made really hard for election workers after a 15-hour day mm-hmm. to make mistakes, the software is at fault, not the election workers.
That has been a problem, obviously, for years. And it has caused, you know, problems in election after election that, as you say, Duncan, are not nefarious. They're just, you know, poorly designed software where those kind of mistakes are easy.
It's
to
crap software.
Right, exactly. But in truth, you know, the hand examination that you guys are calling for in this letter of the ballots, at least in my opinion, of computer tallied ballots, given how crap the software is, that seems to me it should be routine by now in any election. But as you guys note in your letter, there are additional reasons this year to be concerned. You know, you've always been very good about putting these matters into sort of understandable terms. Can you perhaps offer sort of a simple scenario, a fictional for now scenario for lay people like me, how a breach of the voting system that we've seen, like those in recent years by Team Trump, how that could then be misused to change actual results like those that we saw on November 5 in such a way that we wouldn't have already noticed it by now? How might that actually happen in any specific state or county?
Oh, I think so. We know that most of the ESNS system has been exported to the web mm-hmm. and is available to any and all bad actors. We know for sure that the Dominion system mm-hmm. has been exported and is available. Mm-hmm. And we know from studies of both systems that they fail to provide the kinds of security issues that would prevent bad things from happening. So I will go back. I used to own a boat. I read Chapman's Seamanship. And in Chapman, he frequently says, the prudent seaman will XXX, have more than one way of communicating, mm-hmm. have more than one method of propulsion. Given that what we know is that all of this horrible software has been gone into the wild, the prudent election director will take absolutely every possible method mm-hmm. to verify that the certified results are in fact correct. Mm-hmm. But as long as it's inside a computer, unless it's verified and cross-referenced with risk-limiting audits mm-hmm. against the paper, we don't know that what we are seeing as the results are in fact the results.
But what I'm trying to get at is, if let's say you and I are bad guys and I want to pay you a whole lot of money to steal an election, what would you do? What would you be able to do if you had access to that software? How would that how would a very simple attack on the system actually work out in a way that because you have the software, it is made that much easier?
Oh, well, so the standard argument, almost nobody at the elections actually looks at the paper that says who they voted for. So, you know, you want to change 10% of the votes. Mm-hmm. You go in randomly and you choose 1 in 10 votes and you flip.
And that could be done either like in Georgia, for example, where they use touchscreen computers to print out the ballot. That could be done when
anywhere
those ballots are printed
out. BMDs.
BMD, ballot marking devices. But it could also be done on the scanner side, correct? That you count every tenth vote differently. Now, I mentioned a couple of examples of sort of still unexplained anomalies during tabulation of absentee ballots last week in two of the battleground states, Pennsylvania, in a jurisdiction that uses systems made by your friends at ESNS, and in Michigan, where systems made by Dominion are used. In both of those cases, absentee ballots were reportedly went through the scanners just fine, but for still unknown reasons, they did not get added to the overall results to the database when they were uploaded to the central server. Might that be an example of a malware attack sort of gone wrong, as much as it could be a simple programming error somehow?
It could be malware. I have always said that it is easier to attribute to incompetence it is easier to attribute to malfeasance what is equally explained by incompetence. Mm-hmm. One of the big problems is that apparently neither ESNS nor Dominion actually verifies that the cheat sheets at county headquarters for who gets votes mm-hmm. are the same as the cheat sheets at polling places. This is absolutely bananas. We could not sign contracts over the web if we could not verify that the two documents were the same.
When you say cheat sheets, of course, you mean the way that the ballots are programmed to be scanned at the precincts matches up with the database, the programming at the central headquarters.
Yes. Okay. And, you know, who gets the counts? Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, this is, and I have seen these errors from 2010 through 2018 and then into now. This happens over and over and over again. And it's a no-brainer that I would fail a second semester computer science student for doing.
Well, where there's a mismatch between the two sides. And we saw something similar, I believe, in Antrim County, Michigan, back in 2020 that freaked out Republicans. But here, Duncan, we're actually talking about ballots that were scanned, were uploaded. Everything presumably went fine until they noticed that, those 13,000 ballots we uploaded aren't actually in the system at all. There's no results for anybody from those 13,000 ballots. It's that kind of mistake that kind of problem that certainly concerns me because it's still unexplained. Now, Duncan, Dominion has said, as you guys detail in your letter, that giving its software to biased actors would cause, quote, irreparable damage to the election security interests of the country. That's the vendor Dominion. Before the breaches in Georgia, the Coffee County breach that we sort of helped expose on this show, before that had been confirmed, as your letter points out, the Georgia Secretary of State's chief information officer testified that having copies of that software would provide a, quote, roadmap to the way the systems could be accessed. And the Georgia State Attorney General refused to provide copies of their software that is used across the state to Trump lawyers, stating that doing so would provide, quote, the keys to the kingdom. And yet, Trump supporters got access to those keys to the kingdom, and a little, if anything, was done, to my knowledge, in response. What should have been done at that time that was discovered, as you see it, Professor?
I'm a computer science professor. I'm not a lawyer, but I would have argued that kind of disclosure of a proprietary information which would trigger contract disputes, and B, public information that was relevant to counting votes. That should have been a huge red flag. And the fact that there was nothing done, to me, I don't understand why there was not a serious investigation, because, you know, it is the keys to the kingdom. Basically, the state of Georgia gave away the state of Georgia's votes by not following up.
Have you seen anything specific since the election? I mentioned a couple of, we'll call them anomalies at the moment in two states. Have you seen anything specific since the November 5 election that specifically worries you, that you would like to see more examination of, or is your call to do a hand count of paper ballots, or at least a sample of paper ballots? Is that just something you're doing for you know, just to be safe? Is there any specific reason we should worry based on what you have seen since Election Day?
I have to admit, not that I have seen that I would. So I have seen a bunch of things about shifts in votes. I have not seen the political scientists explain to me why those shifts might have happened.
When you say shifts, you mean like from previous year, from the 2020 election to this year's election?
Yeah, previous fractions of 2020 versus R versus D to now. It could be that was messaging. I don't know. So I've seen a bunch of those. I haven't seen anything that I would consider conclusive. I have heard, and this is almost not for attribution, I have heard that there are 10 times more bullet ballots only for president in a couple of states than 4 years ago.
Do you want to explain what bullet ballots are for folks who might not know?
Only for the president and nobody else down the ballot. You know, fractions of like 10% of the total. Now, I don't know how those people have gotten the individual cast vote records. I have gone back and I pinged the South Carolina data I have, and I'm getting 0.6% of votes that were either only straight party, which South Carolina permits, or only for president and nobody else further down.
So it's rare that you would see that many so-called bullet ballots in an election.
Absolutely. I mean, if in fact those numbers stand out, that has to be something to look at, because I have not seen that in, and I've got five biennials from South Carolina statewide. I've got 9 million South Carolina individual votes in my database. And I have not seen, you know, these bullet ballots only for president and nobody else further down the ballot.
And let me offer, well, a thought on that, that, again, these are still very unconfirmed numbers as far as these bullet ballots go, and the reportedly large amounts there were. Now, some have explained this as saying, well, you know, Donald Trump was saying, hey, just go in and vote for me. That's the only thing that matters. And that a lot of people, voters who hadn't done so before, may have gone in, marked their ballot for Trump, and that was that, cast that ballot, which makes perhaps sense. Perhaps it's a good explanation. However, and again, these are not confirmed numbers. I'm just putting it out there for discussion, so people, you know, may want to look in their own jurisdiction. But that occurred in a number of the swing states, the battleground states, but that in neighboring states, right by those same battleground states, that didn't happen. There was a very tiny or normal number of bullet ballots, right?
Exactly. I mean, Arizona stands out compared to Nevada and Utah in this regard. Mm-hmm. And, you know, frankly, you look at North Carolina, which had the governor on the ballot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, duh. You're going to vote for president, but not for governor in the state of North Carolina? Well, not in those numbers of votes.
I mean, of course, in that case, you had kind of a crazy guy running on the Republican side for governor, a guy who claimed he's a black Nazi. But again, something like that be exposed with the hand counts that you guys are calling for? Would something like that be exposed to be a problem or a programming error? Is there something that we could learn from a hand count when it comes to things like that?
Oh, I think if we did a hand count and, you know, statistically, I'm not a statistician. Mm-hmm. I would say, you know, you go down the street to talk to your friendly neighborhood statistician and you get his advice as to when you count and how you count and when you can quit. I would think those would be things that could be certainly done and would give you a feeling that maybe there were a lot of people who voted Republican for president and really didn't like that guy for mm-hmm. governor. Mm-hmm. But, you know, at a second level on the ballot, you know, that to me doesn't normally not get votes.
And would that be confirmed? Is that something that we would want to confirm that, oh, in fact, yes, here's the ballot and here, in fact, is...
Right.
This many voters who voted only for Donald Trump in this case.
Right. As I say, you go to your friendly neighborhood statistician and you say, how many votes do I need to count before I'm convinced that this is really the sort of thing that would have happened?
Mm-hmm.
And that would be possible.
Well, I got to tell you, I hate statisticians. I hate political scientists as far as using them to determine if our elections were, recorded accurately as per voter intent, because there's sort of always an explanation you can come up with for why people voted this way. There are always statistics that you can come up with that raise questions about the results. But answering those questions, frankly, Duncan Buell, if there is zero signs of fraud or error, don't all voters have the right to know that elections are tabulated accurately as per voter intent to the best of our ability, whether it's Trump voters concerned in 2020, whether it's Kamala Harris voters concerned in 2024? Don't we all deserve to have that confidence in the results? And do you believe that our current system as is provides that confidence to voters as best as possible?
I believe voters absolutely have the right to feel that their votes were counted and counted correctly. Do I believe that the statistics? So I have been longstanding an opinion that all of the cast vote record, the individual votes anonymized by order, mm-hmm. should be made public, because if everybody can analyze those, the people who want to claim fraud mm-hmm. will have to show why. And the people who want to point out, no, it wasn't fraud, will have the same data. I am a big believer in both sides being able to analyze the individual cast vote records to be able to determine what really did happen.
Last related question here before I let you go. So the cast vote records is sort of a database where each line, kind of like an Excel spreadsheet, where each line is a single ballot and shows how the voter voted in each of the races. But matched up to that is something called a ballot image. When you scan your ballot, when a ballot gets scanned now in most of the systems used around the nation, an actual photograph is taken of that ballot. And there are election integrity advocates, folks who I've worked with for years, guys like John Brakey in Arizona, who have said, look, you need to release the cast vote record, and it needs to be tied to actual ballots, to the actual ballot images that are digital images that can be released really, you know, the day after the election, that people can match up a vote and look at the actual ballot image to determine if, in fact, it was tallied correctly into the cast vote record, from the image to the record. Is that something additionally that you would call for that would help add confidence to this mess of an election system we have in the U.S.?
I think yes. I have personally not done much with ballot images because, frankly, I don't have the software that will scan the images. But I do have software that will deal with the spreadsheets. And so I think it's a multi-step thing. I mean, if the ballot image people can verify that the difference between ballot images and what the spreadsheet is down in the noise because of mismarked things or, you know, filled in bubbles for more than one place, that's good. I have not done that. I have done an enormous amount of work on what amounts to the spreadsheets. And I think this kind of transparency has to make voters feel more confident, because anybody can analyze this. And you want to complain, you have to complain, and somebody else has the same data, and they can, you know, point out why your complaint doesn't hold up.
And of course, the problem is a lot of jurisdictions do not release that information. They do not release it in certainly in time to check election results while there are still time to perhaps adjust them as needed, which is what you guys are calling for, you and other computer science and voting system experts are calling for in your 5-page letter to Vice President Kamala Harris, to try to request, given the breaches that have occurred in the system since 2020.
Right. I would not have been able to do what I was able to do if it had not been the case that South Carolina declared all the data to be public record. I found all kinds of, you know, errors, overtime, different places, 100 votes here, 100 votes there. I never saw patterns. But I saw the same errors over and over and over again.
At least you saw them. It would be nice if we could all see them in all of the states in question. That's what you guys are asking for in your letter. Listen, Duncan, I got to get out. But do let us know if you hear anything back from the Harris team on this. I'm not sure what the deadlines are in the varying states to ask for this oversight, this public oversight and transparency. But I hope your letter helps us get it this year. Duncan Buell is the NCR Chair Emeritus in Computer Science and Engineering at the University of South Carolina. And you can find him on the site still known as Twitter at Duncan Buell. Duncan, always great speaking with you, my friend. Thank you so much.
Thanks. I think I'm the only Duncan Buell in the country, so I can easily be reached.
You can easily be found. Thank you, sir. Okay.
I had a really quick question before we move on.
Yes.
So it seems a bit unlikely that the Harris campaign will risk the kind of blowback that they would get if they tried to pursue recounts.
Because they're, now they're big Trump MAGA stop the Steelers if they bring this stuff up.
Exactly. So I'm wondering, are there other groups that can bring this? Because I just, that seems to be the way forward.
Well, no one has the
standing,
the gravity that she does if she would ask for something like this. The candidate doing it is the best route forward.
Yes.
Can other people do it? Well, out here in California, any voter can ask for a recount in any precinct or county if they are willing to pay for it, which can be expensive. And
but
so the rules are different in each state.
Okay. So basically, if you're in one of those states, check and see what the rules are and maybe be somebody who does that.
And listen, some of these states are and counties are going to have a small, limited risk-limiting audit in some places. But the question is, you know, when does it happen? As Free Speech for People points out, a lot of times it's going to happen after the certification deadline, when if it shows there has been a problem, it is largely too late to do anything about it.
But so that's why it's important.
It's still good to do. It's better if they do it now. It's better if the vice president asks to have it done, because she has the standing to at least make that request before they find reasons why they don't want to. All right, let's take a quick break here because we are running long, and we'll come back with some amusing news, I think, today about Alex Jones and my own experiences with him some years ago, if we have time, and Desi Doyen and the Green News Report. That is all still ahead on today's broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman.
The Bradcast and the Green News Report are 100% independent, 100% listener supported. But we can't do it alone. We need you. Please help us bring real facts to listeners at independent stations around the nation. Please drop by bradblog.com/donate. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Hey, this is Brad. You're listening to an encore presentation of the Bradcast. Welcome back. It's the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. So this is fun, and we could use, I think some fun today.
Yes, definitely.
You may have heard, but as Oliver Willis over at Daily Coast describes it today in his headline, quote, Alex Jones literally owned by the libs now. As AP reports today, the satirical news publication The Onion won the bidding war for Alex Jones's InfoWars at a bankruptcy auction, backed by families of Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting victims whom Jones owes nearly $1.5 billion in defamation judgments. That for calling the 2012 massacre a hoax. The purchase turns over Jones's entire company, which for decades has peddled in conspiracy and misinformation, says AP, to a humor website that plans to launch the InfoWars platform, to relaunch the InfoWars platform in January as a parody. Within hours of the sales announcement on Thursday, InfoWars website was down and Jones was broadcasting from what he said was a new studio location. I went to the site just before air, and all it currently says is, quote, site unavailable till further notice.
That's promising.
Quote, the dissolution of Alex Jones's assets and the death of InfoWars is the justice we have long awaited and fought for, said Robbie Parker, whose daughter Emily was killed in the 2012 shooting in Connecticut, in which 20 children between the ages of 6 and 7 were murdered by a lone gunman along with 6 adult staff members. Up for grabs at the auction were InfoWars production rights and materials, the InfoWars store, domain names, production equipment, and other assets, including a Teradyne armored truck and a Winnebago motorhome that can be purchased in their entirety or in parts, according to the firm that was running the asset auction. The Onion acquired the conspiracy theory platform, the website, the social media accounts, the studio in Austin, Texas, trademarks, video archives for an undisclosed sale price, the proceeds from which will be presumably handed to the victims' families. Jones filed for bankruptcy in late 2022, and a judge in June allowed him to liquidate his personal assets to help pay off the verdicts. The satirical outlet, which carries the banner of America's Finest News Source on its masthead, was founded in the 1980s. It has skewered politics and pop culture for decades, including making Jones a frequent target of its mocking articles. Mass shootings in the U.S., such as the Sandy Hook attack, are often followed by The Onion publishing slightly updated versions of one of its most well-known recurring pieces, quote, no way to prevent this, says Only Nation, where this regularly happens. One of the attorneys for the families said in a statement, our clients knew that true accountability meant an end to info wars and an end to Jones's ability to spread lies and pain and fear at scale. By divesting Jones of InfoWars assets, the families and the team at The Onion have done a public service and will meaningfully hinder Jones's ability to do more harm. The Onion said in a post on the sale, quote, no price would be too high for such a cornucopia of malleable assets and minds. And yet, in a stroke of good fortune, a formidable special interest group has outwitted the hapless owner of InfoWars, a forgettable man with an already forgettable name, and forced him to sell it at a steep bargain. Of course, Jones said, this is a total attack on free speech. The deep state is completely out of control. This is tyranny of the New World Order, desperate to silence the American people. That's what he said. That's actually his quote, if not me making fun. Anyway, this is interesting. Ben Collins, the CEO of The Onion's parent company, the satirically named corporate giant called Global Tetrahedron, told the AP in a video that it will relaunch the InfoWars website in January with satire aimed at conspiracy theorists and right-wing personalities, as well as education information about gun violence prevention from the group Every Town for Gun Safety. And yes, that is the same Ben Collins who some of you may have seen for years as an NBC correspondent reporting on online right-wing hate groups and conspiracy mongers. This is what he now does. Apparently, he owns The Onion.
Yes, he does.
And now, Alex, all of Alex Jones' base, I guess, are belong to The Onion. Another deep cut. Anyway, I will. I think this is good and happy news. The Onion, which bills itself as the world's leading news publication, it says it has 4.3 trillion daily readers. Recent headlines have included, Trump boys have slap fight over who gets to run foreign policy meetings, and Oklahoma law requires 10 commandments to be displayed in every womb. So anyway, I will take this opportunity to note some of my own personal experiences with the late Alex Jones. Well, I guess he's not really late.
Not
but
really
anyway, and I don't know if I've ever talked about this on the air or not, but I used to appear with some regularity on his show way back in the day during the George W. Bush years, not long after he had started his show. And back then, I will note, he was not insane. At least he was not an insane right-wing conspiracy monger, at least not the one that he has become in the ensuing 20 years. And he was willing to have me on the show to talk about my reporting at BradBlog when too many in the corporate media back then would not. He was, back in that day, an opponent of George W. Bush and the war in Iraq, et cetera, and he had concerns about electronic voting systems, which had just come into being, really, after the 2000 election in Florida, in which Republicans did not want to count the perfectly countable paper ballots that were cast by voters, because had they done so, well, Bush would have lost to Al Gore. So they pretended that the problem was the paper ballots, and so they rolled out the often 100% unverifiable computerized voting and tabulation systems that we are still saddled with today, though in truth, they were far worse back then, as the industry and the Republicans were hoping to move every jurisdiction to 100% unverifiable touchscreen voting systems. Most of those are gone, not in Georgia, and some other states, but I was breaking a lot of stories about the, you know, the failures and the vulnerabilities of those systems. He would have me on to talk about those things and the corruption at the companies that made them, like Diebold and ESNS, as we were talking about in the previous segment. And then Alex Jones just started lifting entire articles from BradBlog.com. And reposting them on his site without even asking my permission. So at one point I called him and I said, hey man, if you want to copy and paste, if you know, the opening paragraphs or something with a link to bradblog.com to read more, well, that'd be fine. But posting the entire thing over at InfoWars was not helpful.
Don't steal my traffic.
Well, it was also harmful because I would update and, you know, correct stories and so forth, but he wouldn't have those updates and the corrections.
Yep.
And he freaked out about it at me on the phone. Brad, you're getting more traffic than you'd ever have. And why are you complaining? And anyway, I complained. And I don't know if he ever invited me back onto a show thereafter, which was fine, because over the years, he would just get more and more insane and more right-wing. When Obama came to power, that's kind of when he turned. He started making claims that Obama was a puppet of dark global conspiratorial forces, you know. And I thought, okay, that's his shtick. He's going to go after whoever's in power, which in and of itself is not a horrible thing. But he was just making up more and more absurd lies and nonsense. You had to sort of, you know, get crazier and crazier because that's how, well, right-wing conspiracy radio works. And then Donald Trump showed up. Suddenly, he was no longer going after those in power. Now he was buddying up with them, which is the complete opposite of what he had pretended to be for all of those years because, you know, I guess nothing corrupts like power and being close to it. But of course, his lies about Sandy Hook, his horrific lies and about that and other mass shootings, which led his supporters to actually confront the victims' families. Well, that finally undid him. And this is where we are today with what we will call a moderately satisfying, perhaps, end to an otherwise horrific and ugly tale. And speaking of horrific and ugly tales, let's get to it. Our latest Green News Report.
We are in the midst of a record-breaking dry spell, not just in New Jersey, but across the entire Northeast.
New York and New Jersey grapple with record drought and autumn wildfires. Republicans win U.S. House majority and the power to reverse Biden climate action. Plus,
the sound you hear is the ticking clock.
UN Climate Summit kicks off with very high stakes.
All of those ticking clocks and more straight ahead from BradBlog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
I don't want anyone to panic, but this weekend there were wildfires all over the New York area. Evidently, Mayor Adams is finally getting serious about the war on rats.
Gotta do what you gotta do. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, I know they're getting down to business in Azerbaijan, but first, they're getting down to business here in the U.S. House?
Yes, Republicans have won a narrow majority in the U.S. House with total control over Congress and climate denier Donald Trump in the White House. Republicans now have the power to demolish a host of climate, pollution, and conservation laws and policies when they take power in January.
Yay.
But the climate hits keep on coming anyway. In New York and New Jersey, the driest conditions in 120 years are fueling rare wildfires in areas that have seen no significant rain since August. Two suspects have been separately charged in setting some of the fires, including one that killed a forest ranger. New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy on Wednesday asked the public to conserve water to stave off mandatory restrictions.
The big picture takeaway is that every one of us needs to do whatever we can to conserve water, because by every indication, it looks like we have as well a very dry winter ahead of us. Yes, that means this drought could grow even more severe.
Yay.
At the UN COP29 climate talks now underway in the oil state of Azerbaijan, money is the focus as negotiators attempt to hammer out provisions under the Paris Climate Agreement to generate trillions of dollars in finance, with wealthy countries like the U.S. that got rich off of fossil fuels helping developing nations shift to clean energy sources and afford the cost of adapting to loss and damage from climate impacts, which they largely did not cause. Without financing, green transitions in developing nations will not happen fast enough to prevent catastrophic global warming, analysts say. Contentious questions include how much money, who should pay, how it should be structured, and who will control it. Current U.S. climate envoy John Podesta told the conference on Monday that the fight for climate action will not stop under a re-elected Donald Trump, even if some progress is reversed.
Some progress.
And he says focus will now move to the states. This week, the CEO of ExxonMobil urged Trump not to withdraw from the Paris Agreement and forfeit its seat at the negotiating table. The president of host nation Azerbaijan defended his own country's increased production of oil and gas, calling them, quote, a gift from God. That just days after a senior Azerbaijan conference official was caught on tape using his role to secretly arrange fossil fuel side deals.
Oh, working out very nicely already.
UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres cited the increase in devastating extreme weather disasters around the world in 2024 as, quote, a masterclass in human destruction, and said increased funding is in the best interest of all countries.
Climate finance is not charity. It's an investment. Climate action is not optional. It's an imperative. Both are indispensable to a livable world for all humanity and a prosperous future for every nation on Earth.
With the U.S. expected to withdraw from its climate commitments, experts say the hope is that other nations will now step up, like the European Union. UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer announced new emissions targets, pledging to cut UK carbon emissions 81% by 2035.
Wow.
The UK is one of a handful of countries that are on track to meet their emissions reduction goals.
Thank you, UK.
Bolivia announced a $5 billion agreement to fund protection of its rainforest, and the conference did achieve an early success, agreeing to final rules to operationalize a global carbon market, a key step toward allowing countries to trade emissions credits in projects that reduce carbon pollution. That, in turn, is expected to unlock billions in funding for conservation and mitigation projects in the developing world.
Well, let's hope the rest of the world can drag us along with them. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
We are the future. Let's get to work.
Let's get to work indeed. Thank you very much, Desi Doyen, our producer. Thanks to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's program, download it anytime for free at bradblog.com. Made possible by those of you who hit a donate button there, or go straight to bradblog.com/donate. Thanks as well to my guest today, Duncan Buell of the University of South Carolina. Drop me an email if you like. I am bradcast@bradblog.com. On the Facebooks, Mastodon's, the site still known as Twitter, I am The Brad Blog. See you there. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman, and I mean it. Good luck, world.
You're listening to The Bradcast. We are 100% listener-supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.